Hello, everybody. It's good to see you. Today, we're going to be doing session three, and it's actually one of my favorite sessions. Actually, I have a lot of favorite sessions because all this information is so critical to put it together so that we can learn the synergy associated with all the factors. The title of today's session is looking at optimizing circulation and heart health. Now, that's a pretty broad title, and almost seems like kind of a boring title unless you understand the implications. Ultimately, we cannot be healthy if we don't have good circulation. In fact, it's been said that in order to be healthy, one must first have a healthy circulation. And that involves every single organ system of the body. That organ system will not be healthy if we don't first have good blood circulating to that area. And so first and foremost, we must make sure that we're taking care of our circulatory system, which is initiated by the pump of the body. What's the most important pump of the body? It's the heart. Now, one of the great values of exercise is that when we exercise, we put into motion a much larger pump. Every single muscle of our body has the capacity to assist the heart in pumping blood back to the heart. See, if everything's backlogged, the heart not only has to pump blood to the tissues, but then it has to push it back up to the heart. And so that's a tremendous load on the heart unless we are actively exercising. Now, one of the big issues that affects circulation is inflammation. Whenever I use the term inflammation, I frequently kind of get a stare and says, what do you mean, inflammation? Where? Where's the inflammation? It's everywhere. That's the problem with inflammation, is that it's systemic. It goes everywhere. And exercise is a powerful way to lower inflammation. More on that in a little bit. But the overall theme that we're going to be discussing tonight has to do with the wellness approach to evaluating and treating cholesterol, insulin resistance, thyroid, and other advanced risk factors, other advanced cardiovascular or circulatory risk factors. So we got a lot to cover today, so let's just get right into it. Well, less than a month ago, I had the opportunity to sit in at a lecture. It was a very intimate gathering. There was only about 10 of us in this conference. And Dr. Paul Zitka, who's a physician and a PhD researcher, he's a director of the Florida Lipid Institute. He's a lipidologist, which means that he is an expert, a specialist in helping other doctors get their patients' cholesterol and lipid values under control. It was a fascinating opportunity. I actually got to quiz him or ask him questions for about 2 hours. I learned a lot. In fact, I'm not making this up. A student on the left, a professor and maestro on the right, Dr. Paul. I learned a lot from him recently because sometimes we spend decades with certain ideas and concepts, and actually, those concepts may have been disproven 20 years ago. Like the year after we learned it, it could have been disproven. So that's why it's critical that we try to keep up to date. And the main theme that I want you to understand is what Dr. Paul Zitka mentioned just a few weeks ago. He said 60% of patients having heart attacks have completely normal lipid profiles. Their cholesterol's normal, their triglyceride blood fats are normal, their good cholesterol, HDL, is normal, their LDL, quote, bad cholesterol, is normal. In other words, as he put it, you're better off flipping a coin to decide whether you're at risk of a heart attack than just doing a traditional lipid profile. Now, don't misunderstand me. I think a traditional lipid profile is very valuable. It can give us a lot of information. But we have to recognize that it picks up only 40% of the risk that we have for a heart attack or stroke. In fact, a lipid profile is not FDA approved to pick up risk for a stroke at all. It's primarily for heart attacks. And so we need to go beyond that to establish what our risk is. Now, there's the main issue, and I use this analogy many places. When we're talking about diabetes, it seems that as I work with individuals who've had diabetes for a long time, it's very clear that the management focus of their diabetes has become so all-consuming in the medical visit that everything is about controlling blood sugar. Now, fortunately, there are standards that say basically everybody with diabetes needs to be carefully monitored for their lipids, their cholesterol value, their triglycerides, etc. They need to be carefully monitored for their blood pressure and managed. In fact, it's been said, one physician who was the managing partner of a large medical group I worked with, he said, in order to properly treat diabetes, that person has to be on at least 7 different prescription medicines, most of them related to high blood pressure. And even if they don't have high blood pressure, they're on cholesterol medications, even if they don't have high cholesterol, why? Because the risk for cardiovascular disease, for heart attacks and strokes, is so great that the standard of care is to aggressively manage those risk factors. But here's the problem. Again, those risk factors only represent 40% of the risk. So no matter how aggressive you have been in those, you're still missing potentially 60% of the risk that could be dramatically reduced if we are aware of what that risk is. So cholesterol values, triglyceride values, the good and the bad cholesterol, only represent the very tip of the iceberg. Underneath the ocean surface, we have this mammoth amount of risk that is represented by this huge ice flow that is underneath the ocean surface. That is what I refer to as the metabolic mess, whether we're dealing with diabetes or hypertension or cardiovascular disease or immune disorders, whatever health concerns you have, we have to focus on that hidden risk. If we don't, we're going to miss the vast majority of the risk in your life or in my life. Okay, so it was interesting. So about I mentioned earlier in session one, I believe, that when I was 24 years old, I thought it was, you know, Mr. Fitness, Mr. Health, and it just so happened that right in 1984, the doctors Brown and Goldstein won a prize in medicine, the Nobel Prize for discovering that the LDL cholesterol, that quote bad cholesterol, was primarily responsible for causing heart disease. So I said, well, I'm going to get my cholesterol checked. You know, I've been vegetarian all my life, and I exercise every day, so I'm going to be pretty good. And as I mentioned, I ended up having a sky-high cholesterol. It wasn't even on the chart. I was above 95th percentile. By the way, that means that at least 95% of individuals my age had a cholesterol level lower than I did. You don't want to have a cholesterol level that is higher than 95% of people your age. You don't want to have a cholesterol level that is that is higher than 50% of people your age, right? We're not talking about wanting to be normal. Normal is not healthy anymore. In fact, maybe it never was. Okay, we want to be optimally healthy. How do we optimize circulation by paying attention to these risk factors? And so, I decided about 6 years later. I'm now 30 years old. I'm practicing nutritional medicine and lifestyle medicine at the Loma Linda University Faculty Medical Group in Sun City, which is not too far from Fallbrook, where we're sitting here today. And this is a retirement community, and so there's a lot of healthcare needs. And so I just said, you know, I'm going to check. I've been much more careful with my diet ever since I became aware that it's not just about being vegetarian. It's not just about being fit, that we have to pay attention to all the factors, a comprehensive wellness program. And so I had, at that point, moved away from using egg yolks, moved away from using one of my favorite foods, you know, ice cream. I moved away from dairy in general, cheese. You know, I had been an expert in high school on exotic cheeses, and I'd chosen joyfully to give those up, to limit myself. You know, we talked last session about how important it is for us to learn how to set limits. See, the bottom line, or the reality is that if we don't learn how to set limits on our lives are going to set limits on us, right? And so we have to decide what's more important. Yeah, I had to decide what was more important, eating my cheese or having a reasonable expectation to be around in 20 or 30 years when my daughters are getting married. Or when my children now have their children, I want to be able to play basketball with them. I want to be able to enjoy being with them. I don't want them to talk about me like, unfortunately, I once in a while talk about my grandfather. Because, you see, my grandfather was a wonderful man. He was a Christian pastor. Everybody loved him. He had six children. Six of them, or four of them, actually went on to go to medical school and became physicians. But you see, he died of a massive heart attack the year before I was born. I never had the opportunity to spend time with my grandfather, ever. He was never, ever there for me. Why? Because he wasn't aware of his risk. Now, that was in 1959, 1958. That was a long time ago. We have come a long way in being able to objectively and categorically figure out what our risk is right now. Right now. And those are the things I want to be sharing with you tonight and throughout this series, is that no longer do we need to suffer the fate of my grandfather, who missed out on a big part of his life, of that joy of seeing his grandkids grow up. He was an avid golfer, by the way. I would have loved to have been his little caddy. You know, I would have loved that. But I missed out on that because heart disease, a massive heart attack, took him away. Now, even though I'd oftentimes been sad about that fact, for some reason, even into my late 20s, early 30s, I had not recognized that somehow my grandfather dying of a massive heart attack reflected on me in some way. I just thought, well, you know, it was too bad that this happened. But then when my uncle, who was just a little bit older than my father, who's an ER physician in Texas, got up to deal with a patient in the ER and fell over dead of a massive heart attack. In the ER! It wasn't until that event when I was actually in the middle of my professional training that all of a sudden the lights came on. And when I said to myself, if this can happen to Uncle Gordon in his early to mid-50s, I forget the exact age, maybe that can happen to me. Now, I happen right now to actually be in my mid-50s. Somehow that is more meaningful to me right now. So what information do I now have available today that my grandfather didn't have and that my Uncle Gordon didn't have, even though they were well-trained in medicine? We've come a long way. And so I decided to do this little project on myself. I said, you know, I've come a long way in the last 6 years. I'm helping so many people reverse heart disease, improve their diabetes, do so many things. So what would happen? You know, my cholesterol typically still ran a little bit higher than I thought it should. And as you can see here on the screen, my baseline cholesterol was 190. So what would happen if I kind of just went back to, it's still technically a vegetarian diet, but it's a lacto-ovo vegetarian diet with few limits put on that beyond the fact that it's vegetarian. So I started just doing a 3-week research project. I added cheese and pizza to my fare, my diet, and that was pretty good. You know, I've never minded enjoying some gooey cheese in pizza. I added some ice cream as a dessert. I wasn't going like crazy. I was just eating my regular diet, and I was just adding some other foods in. I started drinking milk, regular milk, and things like that. And you see, for me, what happened in 1 week, my cholesterol went from 190 to 230. By the second week, it had gone to 257. And by the third week, 21 days of still eating a very, what most people would consider balanced, is certainly a much better diet than the standard American diet. I was just adding in a lot of saturated fat coming from dairy, cheese, and ice cream, and so forth. I had a little cheesecake thrown in once in a while. By the third week, 21 days, cholesterol's 280. Now, I'm not saying this would happen to you. See, we're all different. We have to figure out what's going on in our bodies. So for me, I was one of those individuals where my standard lipid profile, just looking at my cholesterol and my triglycerides and my HDL and my LDL, that was enough to wave a red flag and say, Wes, what's going on here? Something's wrong. We need to fix this. Okay, and so about 40% of us, that's enough to get aggressive. But especially if we have a problem with cholesterol, we need to now recognize that there's other risk factors that add to that risk in a exponential or synergistic way. I flipped this. In 3 weeks, it came right back down to 190. Some people are much more diet sensitive than others. And sometimes this diet sensitivity suggests that there may be a greater risk for vascular dementia or even Alzheimer's, and we'll get back to that in a minute. Okay, so but one thing I discovered early in my clinical work was that the HDL cholesterol, you know, this healthy cholesterol, we call it the garbage truck. Some refer to it as a tow truck. This good cholesterol will hook on to the bad cholesterol, the plaque-causing cholesterol, the cholesterol that is literally now toxic, has been exposed to free radicals and oxidizing agents and literally toxins in the body, And because of that exposure, it in itself is now toxic and causes heart disease, causes plaque buildup. And so this tow truck, the HDL, will hook up to it and take it back to the liver, make sure that the liver then processes that and gets rid of it. We mentioned briefly in session two that unless you're on a high natural fiber diet, all the work that that HDL tow truck or garbage truck has done to get it out of your arteries and take it to the liver goes to waste because it will get reabsorbed right back in your bloodstream unless you have fiber in your gut. See, the liver dumps it into the gallbladder. The gallbladder then at mealtime dumps it into the small intestine as the food is leaving the stomach and going into the small intestine. It is at that point, if there was abundant fiber in that meal, that fiber will literally grab a hold of that toxic cholesterol that was dumped by that HDL tow truck and never let go. It'll hold on to it, and it'll be eliminated with your next bowel movement. If you don't have adequate fiber in every meal, you're missing the opportunity to get rid of that toxic cholesterol, and you're missing the opportunity to decrease the stress, the inflammatory stress on every organ system in the body, on the brain, the heart, the kidneys, the eyes, everything. Okay, so now what's really interesting, though, about HDL cholesterol, and we call it the HDL paradox. It's been said that on average, if every 1% that you increase the HDL, good cholesterol, you lower your risk of cardiovascular or coronary heart disease by 2 to 3%. So in other words, the higher the good cholesterol, the better, right? Well, that's where statistics kind of get in the way of truth. It's technically true, but it's not necessarily something that applies to you or me. For instance, do you know what happened to me immediately after or while I was eating all that gooey pizza and ice cream for dessert and occasional cheesecake? More saturated fat in my diet. My HDL, my good cholesterol, doubled. I shared that with a cardiologist friend of mine that I worked with at the faculty medical group in Sun City. And, you know, and what he said to me kind of stunned me a little. He says, "Well, see, I told you butter was good for you." And he was one of those guys that you could never read, like, is he joking or, you know? But now as we look back and look at new research, studies have now demonstrated that there is a group of individuals that when their HDL cholesterol is high, it actually represents active coronary heart disease. Cardiovascular atherosclerosis is more active. Another way to look at this is that just having a high HDL, which means you have a whole bunch of tow trucks, a lot more garbage trucks trying to reverse that, take that cholesterol from the artery and take it back to the liver. But what does that tell you? If you have to have lots of garbage trucks and lots of tow trucks, what does that mean? That means you have lots of dysfunctional vehicles on the road that need to be moved away. That means there's a lot of accidents, there's a lot of stalls, which means there's that traffic is going to be crazy and congested. That's a problem. Another way to understand this is the analogy of having an infection and your body responding to that infection with a fever. Is a fever a good thing? Well, none of us like to have a fever because it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good, right? But what would happen to us if we didn't have a fever while we had an infection? Our immune system would not be mobilized nearly to the point that it could be which means we could die from that simple infection simply because the body wasn't able to mobilize an aggressive inflammatory response against that virus or bacteria or whatever it is. So to have a fever is a good thing as long as you're managing it. And it eventually does its job. The problem with a chronically elevated HDL might suggest that you're chronically toxic and chronically inflamed, which means that we need to study what's really going on inside your body. And fortunately, we have advanced cardiac risk factors that help us understand that, evaluate it properly, and then act on it aggressively, all done through lifestyle and nutritional medicine. That's obviously the first step. And of course, there's many medicines that can help manage that too. My goal is to try as much as possible to help people figure out from cause to effect how they can actually control this naturally. And there's plenty of research giving us lots of ammunition on how to do just that. Ironically, some of the healthiest populations in the world, populations that have the lowest documented rates of heart disease, have the lowest HDLs in the planet. Certain Japanese populations, the Tarahumara Indians in southern Mexico, well known for very low cardiovascular risk factors, have HDL levels that by American standards are an independent risk factor for heart disease, even though they actually have the least heart disease of anybody. So it's a real paradox, and what I'm suggesting here is that we can't just flippantly go and look at our lipid risk factors and say, oh, you know, my cholesterol levels are good. Yeah, my cholesterol might be a little high, but my HDL is high enough so that the ratio looks good. Well, it's good that it's high maybe, but it's recognizing that maybe there's a problem and that's why it's high. Okay, so we need to consider those factors. So the problem is that unlike in my case, most people or many people can present with a very healthy-looking lipid profile. The cholesterol, triglycerides, the HDL cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol are all normal. In fact, they may be perfect. Cholesterol 158, the HDL 150, or HDL 43, the triglycerides 70, well under 100. This is the type of person that would oftentimes be sent away after a physical, and they're told, you have no risk, no real risk. But how much of the risk did this test actually represent? Only 40%. So what happened to the other 60%? And this is what oftentimes, if you look at the slide now, this is what oftentimes we can see by doing an advanced cardiac profile, like the Hunter Heart profile that I use in my clinic. And so the first item is the LP, or lipoprotein PLA2, phospholipase A2, which is commonly referred to in the lipidology community as the plaque test. Why? Because it actually measures whether or not you have active plaque in your artery walls. So in other words, no longer do we need to have an invasive procedure to see whether we have plaque in artery. Now, that can be done under certain situations. But this test, the plaque test, the PLA2 test, actually shows us whether there's acute inflammation in the vascular bed, in the inner lining of the artery wall, which means that white blood cells are being attracted, are infiltrating into that inner wall of the artery, and as they do so, these white blood cells literally start chewing up this toxic LDL cholesterol that has been oxidized, it has been basically turned rancid. It has been attacked by free radicals. And because of the lack of adequate antioxidants in the diet, because of the lack of certain vitamins and minerals and nutrients and fiber and other foods, whole foods that are loaded with the antioxidant chemicals, the lack of those nutrients leads to toxicity in the cholesterol, and now the white blood cells are trying to engulf them and chew them up. They literally engulf them and digest them. But these white blood cells keep eating so much. You know what a macrophage, a white blood cell is called a macrophage, is just a word that means big eater. A big eater. They're just sucking up all this toxic cholesterol, but eventually it's eating so much of it that it can't eat another bite. And guess what? It actually dies inside the artery wall, stuffed full of cholesterol. So you know what plaque really is? Plaque is thousands and thousands of dead white blood cells stuffed full of this toxic cholesterol that has crystallized and turned into foam cells that you can actually press like old styrofoam and squeeze together. It's a very, very damaging material to the artery wall. And that plaque can rupture and break open at any moment and liquefy and cause a clot to form almost instantly inside the artery itself. So that's what we're trying to prevent. We're trying to prevent that type of clot that then leads to a thrombus, which now completely plugs blood flow downstream. So if the artery that had a clot is right here, carotid artery, that means everything upstream in the, or downstream in this case, but up in the brain, basically is going to now be ischemic. That's where the strokes come from. If it happens in our coronary artery, those heart arteries, that means that huge area of heart muscle that is being fed by that coronary artery now will no longer have oxygen or nutrients, and those tissues, those muscle layers can die. Okay, so that's why circulation is so critical. So if that plaque test, that PLA2 test, is above 200, that means that there is active, again, vascular inflammation or plaque buildup in somewhere in the bloodstream. That means we need to act right away. This is actually FDA approved for both stroke and heart attacks. So it's a very good test to do, especially if people are talking about, you know, I get chest pain when I go outside and walk. Now, I had a gentleman this week who said just walking after a meal, he gets chest pain. We did this test, fortunately. Fortunately, this test was well under 200, but he had many other tests that were showing a significant problem that we then develop a specific plan for as we move forward. Okay, we'll come back to the plaque test in a minute. Now, the second test here is called the hsCRP. Stands for high sensitivity C-reactive protein, or also referred to as the cardiac CRPs. This is inflammation that influences the risk of heart disease, but it is not specific to the blood vessel wall like the plaque test. It can be high for almost any reason. And so, like for somebody with rheumatoid arthritis or another autoimmune disease, the CRP will tend to be higher, and it may not be influencing plaque at all, but at least not directly. So these tests are very important. Okay, and so there's various tests that we're going to be looking at. Now, so let's talk about inflammation. Even 15 years ago, Time Magazine came out with a cover issue saying the secret killer, and they said a surprising link between inflammation and heart attacks, cancer, Alzheimer's, and other diseases and what you can do to fight it. Wow, that was pretty proactive. That was over 15 years ago. And unfortunately, we're still trying to incorporate these concepts in the typical clinical practice because everything, almost everything, is still just focusing on blood pressure, cholesterol, when those things don't represent the majority of the risk. The Dr. Paul Reiche, a prominent cardiologist out of Harvard, actually did a study showing that as your cardiac CRP, measure of inflammation, gradually increases, it dramatically increases your risk of having a heart attack or a stroke. And so what he did is he divided it into what they call quintiles. They're basically, they divide the risk into five separate groups, equal groups, and so they showed that those who had the lowest risk of having a subsequent heart attack had a CRP level, a measure of inflammation, that was less than 0.6. Now, an optimal level is actually less than 0.35. So the lower the inflammation, the better, and that's a test that I believe everybody should have because that test is twice as predictive of having a cardiovascular event compared to a standard cholesterol test. Okay, so now if your level, once your level reaches 2.0, that means that 60% of Americans have a level of inflammation that's lower than yours. Okay, and so that's the fourth quintile. So if your level reaches 2.0 or a little higher, that means that already the vast majority of Americans are doing better than you are. And once again, we do not ever want to be in a position where the majority of individuals within America have a lower risk than we do, because the average risk is far too high. Okay, so so that's an important test for us to consider, and we're going to be looking at specific things that we can do on a wellness program to change this. So what's interesting is if you were to, when you had this test, if you showed that your plaque test and your cardiac CRP test are both elevated, the plaque test above 200, the CRP above 2.0, that represents an 11-fold greater risk for stroke. Okay? Now, so see, these are the kind of things that I've always wanted to know for myself. Because knowing your statistical risk means that now we can specifically intervene and do something about it right away. We don't have to sit back and go, well, that's horrible. Now I'm going to, 11 times greater risk of stroke? I don't have a chance. Oh, and yes, you do. You have a huge chance by recognizing your risk. Now that's a call to action, right? Awareness is a call to action, and we know how to reverse that risk. The risk that is specifically related to each of these tests, we know how to do that. So, all right. Now, I had an opportunity about 20 years ago now. Is that right? Yeah, to meet Dr. James Bernard. This was 1991, I believe. I was president of the Loma Linda University School of Public Health Alumni Association, which meant that I got to pick the speakers for the conference. That's pretty much all that really meant. But I took advantage of that. I brought in Dr. James Bernard from UCLA School of Medicine, who had worked intimately with Mr. Pritikin, that engineer that figured out for himself how to reverse heart disease, when two of the most prominent cardiologists in Los Angeles told him, "Mr. Pritikin, there's nothing that we can do for you." And he said, "Are you serious? You guys, what, you went to school for how many years, 20 years? Just to tell me that you can't fix me?" Well, Mr. Pritikin, you got to understand. You had 90+% occlusion in multiple blood vessels of the heart, and this has been demonstrated for decades. It's completely irreversible. It can't be fixed. Never tell an engineer that you can't fix something, because engineers know anything is fixable. If you put enough time into it, enough money into it, they can figure out how to fix that problem. And so he said, okay, you're obviously not interested in fixing me, so I'm going to figure it out myself. He spent 20-plus hours every week at UCLA library looking at the research relating to heart disease reversibility. And yeah, he couldn't find much research on humans, but he found tons of research on animals. All kinds of studies have shown you could reverse heart disease in animals. Now, he was intelligent and astute enough to know that even though humans are not animals, that the circulation and the risk factors for heart disease are essentially the same. And so he started applying the knowledge he gained by the medical research that had been in the files for decades, and within weeks, he had reversed his unstable angina, no more chest pain. And within a few months, all his risk factors had come back to normal and he was fully functional. When he passed away some over two decades later, he told his cardiologist friend, he says, I want you to be at my autopsy. And I want you to write an editorial and print it in a medical journal showing what happened to my heart over the last 20 years. He had reversed his heart disease. Okay? He was told that at his death, or he wasn't told, we were told that at his death, that Mr. Pritikin had the arteries of a teenager, not those occluded arteries of a man who is given just weeks to live, but ended up living decades longer. So Dr. James Bernard, who had worked intimately with Mr. Pritikin, he did an interesting study published in 2004. This study was in a group of women, and for just 3 weeks in a comprehensive wellness program where they didn't just exercise, they didn't just eat an optimal plant-based diet, they did everything that was prudent to be part of a healing program. And in just 3 weeks, Dr. Bernard was able to document that their level of inflammation in their blood, their cardiac CRP, dropped 40%. It just plummeted far more than if they'd gone on the medications that lower inflammation, far more than if they'd gone on the statin medications that lower cholesterol and lower inflammation about 30%. See, so when we apply the comprehensive approach, you get comprehensive, dramatic transformation. Now, this was intriguing to me because around the same time at the clinic where I did lifestyle medicine in Guam, we had been demonstrating month after month that in just 2 weeks of individuals on a comprehensive plant-based diet, exercising every day, managing all risk factors, getting them on the appropriate supplements, just looking at everything that made sense, in just 2 weeks, we were able to lower their cardiac CRP inflammation by 50%. Now, Dr. Paul Ridker, who's the cardiologist who first came up with this test from Harvard, he had published a study showing that even people with normal cholesterol values but who had high inflammation were at high risk of heart disease. And so they was about 18,000 people in this study that was supposed to go 4 or 5 years. But after 1 year or 18 months of being on a statin cholesterol-lowering medication, even though they didn't need to be on a cholesterol-lowering medication, those individuals with normal cholesterol lowered their risk of a heart attack by 44%, 18 months. Why? They didn't need to lower their cholesterol, so why did it lower their risk so dramatically? Because it lowers inflammation about 30%. So this was a drug study, and I wanted to be able to report on this drug study and read it more carefully. And this was at a time some years ago where, you know, if you buy it on the internet, it would have cost me like $25 to buy the study. But I knew the trick. There's a trick in the research community that you just email the author, and the author has rights to send you a PDF copy of the study. It's free. So I sent a little email to Dr. Ridker saying, I would really appreciate a copy of your study that I can review. And then I said, by the way, you know, we've been able to reduce cardiac CRP in our clinic by 50% in just 2 weeks by being on a comprehensive lifestyle program and diet. Now, I expected his graduate assistant to send me a copy of his study and say, you know, we're pleased that we could send this to you. Have a good day. And that would be the end of it. But a couple days later, I got an email back that was written by Dr. Paul Ridker. And he said, I am very intrigued by your studies because I fully believe that there's nothing more powerful in lowering inflammation in the body, the type of inflammation that causes premature disease and death, than the optimal diet. This is a guy doing all the drug research. Why would he say that? Because anybody who's done the research has to study the big picture. They have to be able to accurately show what the research demonstrates in other areas. And they all know what the most powerful strategies are for decreasing our risk. Okay, so we learned last session that just exercising every day moderately will lower inflammation in the body by 30%. By the way, drinking enough water, just making sure you're drinking enough water throughout the day, which begins at the start of the day, you want to take in at least 8 ounces of water, preferably about 16 ounces of water. Why? Because you're dehydrated. You've been losing water all night long through your breath, through perspiration, and through creating urine. And so you have to rehydrate. If you don't rehydrate, you're at higher risk of having a clot right then and there. So the first way to lower your risk of having a clot or cardiovascular problems is immediately rehydrate with pure filtered water. And if you have any tendency to constipation, make that warm to hot, and that'll be the trick. Okay, that will, within 10 to 15 minutes of doing that a few days in a row, that will help you have a full elimination, and that will lower your risk of toxicities that cause inflammation as well. Okay, so we also know that the fitter an individual is, overall, on average, lowers their level of cardiac CRP as a measure of inflammation. Even though fitness, as we mentioned in session 2, doesn't in of itself make you healthy, you can still have a heart attack, you can still die prematurely, fitness powerfully alters and mitigates risk in general. So we want to pay attention and include fitness in our overall program. Now, it's interesting that even in the drug studies that look at lowering the risk of or lowering the levels of this plaque in the artery walls, that simply adding a nutrient, a vitamin, niacin, vitamin B3, or essential oils like EPA or DHA can almost double the benefit in many cases that just a regular medication would have. And so the studies are now suggesting that there's a lot of things that we can do to dramatically improve our risk without first having to jump on the medication bandwagon. Well, many researchers, including Dr. Russell Ross, as pictured here on this study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, so that atherosclerosis, heart disease, stroke, basically is an inflammatory disease. This isn't just clogged plumbing. This is an actual inflammatory condition, so we got to learn how to lower inflammation. So the studies continue to show that this plaque formation leads to a vulnerable plaque. And what is interesting here is that as we look at the plaque test, you see the artery inner wall as it's thickening full of this plaque, these foam cells, these white blood cells that are just oozing toxic cholesterol ready to form a clot. You see that little rupture in that plaque on the picture? That is easily picked up by the LP-PLA2 plaque test, which is a simple blood test that can pick up problems in your wrist. Now, Harvard did this wonderful study a few years ago. After all this information about inflammation became apparent, they said, hey, we have blood that's been frozen that has been collected every few years for 30 years, and we now can actually go back to 30 years of frozen blood samples and measure this new blood test. Sure enough, they went and they measured this blood test, the cardiac CRP, for 30 years in a large group of doctors, 50,000 doctors. They had been tested every 2 years since 1976. And from that data, they were able to show, based on careful dietary histories of all these doctors, what the four most inflammatory food groups were. Now, I teased you with this a couple sessions ago. I'm going to actually tell you today. Okay, why? Because it fits what we need to talk about today. Essentially, the most inflammatory food found in the diet that was associated with an elevated cardiac CRP was processed meats. Processed meats dramatically increase the risk of diabetes. One reason, because it's inflammatory. Inflammation turns on the diabetes genes. Processed meats dramatically increase the risk of heart disease. Why? Because it's inflammatory. Inflammation turns on the genes that promote heart disease. And this goes on and on and on. There's a lot of reasons for this. Suffice it to say that processed meats are the meats that are most likely to contain toxins. You know, all this interest in the pesticides found in fruits and vegetables. No, actually, that's important. Don't misunderstand me. I have no problem with people who want to completely go organic. But the amount of pesticides and toxins found in just one serving of animal products far outweighs days and days worth of consuming vegetables and fruits that have been spread with pesticides. Why? Because animals concentrate toxins. We concentrate toxins. And so when we're consuming the flesh of an animal that has concentrated toxins during its entire life, you're getting exposed to a lot of toxicity. Okay, so that's one of the reasons, especially processed meats, because it's organ meats, it's the types of meat that are going to be most toxic, most loaded with heavy metals, and most likely to be infectious, right? There's all kinds of data to support that. So infections do what? They increase inflammation. You're starting to see how all this comes about? Okay, so that's number one. Number two is refined grains. Okay, refined grains. So in other words, you can be purely vegan and have a very inflammatory diet. There's a lot of unhealthy things that are vegan, right? Okay, so the focus here isn't whether you're vegan or vegetarian or paleo. The focus is what's the healthiest diet? What does the science show? Okay, and so they we're wanting to focus on first-class foods primarily. Foods that are known to improve health. Plant-based whole foods are the first thing that we should make sure we're getting plenty of. Third food is, we would all guess this, sweets, sodas, pastries, cakes, things that we have to be careful and limit, right? We have to know how to limit those things because what? They're very inflammatory. They're very refined. It's that's a no-brainer. But the fourth one that's a tougher one. The fourth category of foods isn't actually even a food at all. It's diet sodas. Diet soda. So you say, well, how can a diet soda, something that has no caloric value whatsoever, actually cause inflammation? Well, arsenic and lead and mercury and pesticides and all kinds of toxins have no caloric value whatsoever. They certainly cause inflammation. They certainly cause neurotoxicity. And a new study was just presented at the American College of Cardiology meetings. In fact, I have it here with me. I just saw this in the last few days, and it was very intriguing to me because in this study, they were actually looking at a subset of individuals that had been part of about 60,000 women. Had been involved in this study. It's called the Women's Health Initiative. And Dr. Vyas, who's at the University of Iowa, he found that women who consumed diet sodas on a regular basis, two a day, which by many standards would be thought of as, well, that's no big deal. After all, it doesn't have any calories, so why not? You know, drink up. Just two a day of diet sodas represented a 30% increased risk of developing a heart attack compared to women who drank diet sodas rarely or less often. But it also increased the risk of premature death by 50%. And this is in a study that lasted about 9 years. Okay, so there's all kinds of, you know, things. Well, that study didn't really show that aspartame or diet soda really caused that. Yeah, but all research is based on these principles. Okay, unless it's a specific clinical study. This is a huge epidemiologic study. But then what we got to do is step back, and we need to look at what does the vast array of research support in general. And whether you're talking about weight loss, we know that people who drink diet sodas on a regular basis are much more likely to gain weight even compared to people who drink regular sodas. And that's baffling because regular sodas are loaded with calories, but diet soda has no calories. Inflammation is the big issue, not calories. I'm not saying calories aren't important. I'm saying calories are much less important than inflammation. So that's why we got to focus on those areas. So those are the four most inflammatory groups. So we've talked about the plaque test, but there's two other tests that I want to mention today before we end. There's actually a lot more tests that we need to cover, and we'll be getting into those in session four. But the LP little A, or the lipoprotein A, is a sticky cholesterol. I just call it the sticky cholesterol. And this is actually related to a genetic mutation. So if you have elevated levels, if your levels are above 30 of this LP little a, that represents a risk of heart disease, or the amount of plaque-forming cholesterol that's 10 times higher inside this sticky cholesterol compared to the regular LDL cholesterol. So we want to know this. And there's specific nutritional strategies that work in lowering this risk factor. I tend to have an elevated sticky cholesterol, and so I have developed a plan to make sure that I'm lowering that. And then last of all, for tonight's session, we have this small, dense LDL. This is the LDL cholesterol particle that is actually small. It's so small that it easily infiltrates into the artery wall, causing plaque. And so if we measure this small, dense LDL cholesterol and it's elevated, you can't just take a statin medication. In fact, many of the statin medications will actually increase some of these, the sticky cholesterol or the small, dense cholesterol. So we have to that's why it's so critical that we first and foremost, if I could have the very next to the last slide, please. We need to first and foremost focus on the big picture. Remember, we were talking about the exposome? Okay, it's all the things in our lives. Next to the last slide. All the things in our lives, the choices that we make that influence our risk for some type of serious health problem. That clearly involves our diet, as we've been pointing out today. And as I mentioned in the very first session, every single presentation is going to have some information about diet. It's going to have some information about exercise. But then we're going to be expanding. We're going to be looking at vitamin D. We're going to be looking at other risk factors, about insulin levels, about blood sugar levels, and how a much more detailed analysis of those factors can give us significant insights as to what we can do, what you can do, what I can do to not just manage our risk, but really reverse our risk. As we look at all these risk factors, now we're able to predict well over 90% of our individual risk. I'm not satisfied in just being able to predict 40%, right? That's not adequate. And so what I want to suggest to you tonight is that we work on our wellness program, we need to become experts in setting limits in a good way. You know, anybody who's ever been successful in a business knows that they have to focus on the most important parts of that business. It's called the 80-20 rule. In those of you who registered for this session have been getting the emails, hopefully have already been able to download that worksheet, that handout that talks about how to be successful in any walk of life, but especially here in our wellness program, by setting limits, by choosing the very best of things. And I'll end tonight with one of my favorite statements by Gordon MacDonald, an inspirational author who says, sometimes you have to say no to things you really like to do in order to say yes to the very best of things. So we got to decide what is most important to us and then develop a plan on how we can reach those most important priorities in our lives. And that plan is going to include things that we do, and it must, by definition, include things that we're going to move away from. Otherwise, we're not going to be successful. So I challenge you that over this next week, you really work on figuring out what limits you need to set. Listen, I'm not going to tell you what to do. Okay, I'm giving you the framework so that you can figure this out for yourself. Remember, you are the chairman or the chairwoman of the board of your personal health. Nobody else can do that for you. Thank you. All right, we are now moving into the part of the program where you can ask questions. And so anybody who has a question, I would encourage you to move over to my left where Pastor Jeff Harper can help you. Now, what do we have today, Pastor Jeff? I know I have some questions right now myself, but do you have some that you want to share?
I do have a couple of questions that I can ask you, or if you would like to do those first.
No, go ahead.
That's no problem. All right. So we have two questions here, and again, to the local audience here, if any of you would like to ask a question, just come over here. We have a nice blue line already taping the floor. That was nice of us, so you can stand there. So here's two questions. One, Rebecca from Indiana. She asked, you just shared how the liver dumps into the gallbladder. Now, the gallbladder empties into the small intestine. How is a person's system compromised, or is it, if the gallbladder has been removed?
I saw that one coming.
Are there specific precautions that must be taken in this situation?
Okay, I'm looking at a couple of people right here in the audience that could answer that question really well. It's I'll try to be brief, but actually that's opening up Pandora's box a little bit. The bottom line is that if you don't have a gallbladder, you can't store bile. And so that means that the bile, as it being released by the liver, is just drip, 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 leaking into the small intestine, going into the large intestine, irritating the tissues in the large intestine. And that's where it becomes critically important that we are on a first-class diet, a diet that we will be getting into much more detail as we go through this series. If you're reading the book Goodbye Diabetes, read chapters 12 and 11 and 12 talking about the first-class diet, that outline that in detail. It's a diet that will give you around 45 grams of fiber a day or more. It's that fiber in each meal that then will mop up that excess bile that's irritating the colon wall and prevent it from being more irritating and toxic. In the body, irritation means toxicity. It's bad for the body. Now, there's another part of that question that is really critical, and that is if you don't have a gallbladder, your entire digestion and therefore your health in general is compromised. Now, that's my opinion. I've seen that so many times clinically. I would love to do extensive research on a large body of people and with the main difference being you have a gallbladder or you don't, and track them over 15 to 20 years, and I would bet that not having a gallbladder will dramatically increase the risk for many, many conditions. So that is why if you don't have a gallbladder, then you need to provide something to the body during digestion that supplies what the gallbladder normally would. And so there's a whole strategy in how to do that. It's discussed in some detail in the chapter Optimizing Digestion in the book Goodbye Diabetes.
Thank you so much, Dr. Youngberg. Francis here from our local audience has a question.
Hello, Dr. Youngberg. Yeah. Thank you for being here and making yourself available. Clearly, meats that are grass-fed and free-range chickens and free-range turkeys, et cetera, are better than processed meats. Would you still discourage people not to eat those meats or reduce it, or what's your opinion about that?
Okay. So what about the whole paleo movement, which is focusing on organic, grass-fed meats, as opposed to what we learned earlier about how horrible those processed meats in particular are? Well, obviously, there's going to be, depending on who you ask, you're going to get a lot of different opinions on that. My view on this is that consuming organic meats in moderate amounts is actually a healthier diet than a vegetarian diet that focuses largely on refined products and is not focusing on whole, unprocessed, plant-based foods. Okay? Now, I know I made a lot of enemies by just saying that, okay? but truth is truth. I want to be honest with my conviction about what I see in the literature. Now, that doesn't mean that the optimal diet includes organic or grass-fed meats. I did not say that. Okay, I do not believe that. Okay, what I do believe is that if somebody is insisting on eating a vegetarian diet that largely consumes of many refined products, they would probably be healthier if they shifted to getting rid of all the refined products and adding a little bit of organic meats. If they could certify that meat is disease-free. And that's the challenging one right there. That's, how do you do that? Now, obviously, if an animal has been raised in an environment where it's been exposed to, a healthy environment, right? It's not been exposed to pesticides. It hasn't been pumped full of hormones. It hasn't been given antibiotics day after day to cause it to grow faster so that you have more meat for slaughter. If you have an animal that grows that is raised in a more traditional, healthy environment, of course it's going to be a healthy animal, and of course it's going to be less likely to be riddled with cancer and other disease. But in today's environment, I'm not sure I want to take that risk because disease is so rampant everywhere. And so I personally believe that the healthiest diet is a diet that is focusing on whole unprocessed foods, and we will be getting into what constitutes second-class foods, third-class foods, and so forth. Personally, I choose to consume a diet that is mostly vegan, that is mostly first class, whole plant-based. And I try to limit my temptation to go the route that I did on that research study, because I know what would happen to me if I succumb to that temptation on a regular basis.
Thank you, Dr. Youngberg. We have a question here from Mike from Michigan. And Mike asks, I was trained for a marathon and just completed a 20-mile run. The next day, I got my blood drawn for the CRP. It came back high. Could that have been because of the training?
Absolutely. I know how you feel, Mike. I've been there. I remember when I was training for my first marathon, 1986, very first LA marathon. And a bunch of my roommates from Loma Linda University, we decided, hey, you know, we're just gonna run from Loma Linda to Yucaipa early on a Saturday morning, eat breakfast at Dr. Hildebrandt's house, right, Mrs. Hildebrandt? You remember that? Okay, and then we'll drive down the hill and go to church. Woo! Was that like asking a lot? So at the beginning of that 15-mile uphill run, it was just a little downpour, which it felt great, but our shoes got wet. What's that mean? Shoes got heavy. And about mile 13, all uphill, we all just conked out. And I remember talking to Brent Hildebrandt, who was my running partner at the time, and he's now a family physician in Michigan. And I kept saying, now, what's your mom having for breakfast again? I was so famished. And we were thirsty. And so we finally got there, and we felt so bad that church never happened, number one. And the rest of the afternoon was basically on the couch, comatose. So a hard run, 15, 20 miles, especially as you're training for an event, is actually a major injury on the body. And so, number one, you have to be ready for it. You have to have built up to it, or you're breaking down. You're breaking down. And so, we should actually wait about 2 weeks after a vigorous endurance event, just like San Diego just had their big Ironman. You know, they would want to wait a couple of weeks before they test the measure of inflammation in the body, which goes to show that even a good activity places us at some risk. So we have to be careful in weighing that. Great, great question, Mike.
Thank you, Dr. Youngberg. We have a question from our local audience here from Jack. So Jack, thank you.
Hi, Dr. Youngberg.
Hey, Jack.
I had an incident this last year in July where I had to go to the hospital, and after a lot of testing and everything, they discovered that I had an aneurysm. And I'm just wondering, can you, by better diet, what you've talked about tonight, can those be prevented, or will they happen no matter what?
That's a great question, Jack. So what about aneurysms? Are they preventable? And I suspect that you're inferring that is it possible to prevent a secondary occurrence or to prevent it from getting worse? That's a critical issue. And so bottom line is that aneurysms, like other injuries to the blood vessel wall, relate to inflammation, any irritation that causes strain on that vessel wall that eventually causes that wall to become weak and balloon out. It's just like as some of you may remember as children, you didn't have money to put a new tire on your bike, and pretty soon you see that inner tube kind of ballooning out where that tire was worn thin, and you kind of just rode the bike a little bit too long that way, and pretty soon, and you might have taken the tumble. Well, if that is essentially an aneurysm, and so everything that we're discussing with a comprehensive wellness program has the potential to limit the risk of progression of that aneurysm. Obviously, you want to have good medical evaluation. You want to have careful medical attention. And sometimes those aneurysms can be surgically corrected. And I would absolutely, if I had an aneurysm, I would be looking at all my options while I'm also limiting my risk broadly by paying attention to the factors that we're discussing.
Thank you, Dr. Youngberg. How about we go with some of the questions you mentioned that you...
Okay. We have talked at times about genetic testing. And here's an individual from the Gold Beach, Oregon, who was raised actually an important question. She was essentially saying, you know, I'd like to do some genetic testing, but I'm concerned about the medical legal ramifications. If I find out I have some major mutation, will my insurance company dump me? Well, there are laws that health insurance companies cannot use that information against you. Unfortunately, there are not laws that say that the life insurance companies can't use that information against you. So if you're going to use life insurance, make sure you get that first, and then you do genetic testing. I feel that genetic testing is the wave of the future. It's the way to personalize care. It's the way to recognize what your greatest risk factors are now so that you can prepare for that eventuality and literally nutritionally bypass that risk to a large extent. The other question is that, well, you know, will the insurance companies use this and send this on to government agencies, et cetera? You can actually bypass the insurance company altogether. I have many patients who choose to order our labs and just pay at an 80% discount rate through contracts so that it's just a transaction between the lab and the individual. There's no insurance company involved. That's what I do, frankly. But we also need to recognize that in today's society, if there's anything we've learned over the last months and years, is that nothing is actually private anymore. You know, so if you're waiting for true security relative to your medical record, I fear that you're going to end up suffering all kinds of unnecessary risks because you want to know now. Okay, there's never going to be true security to your medical record, I don't believe. So I actually ignore that part now. I tell anybody what my risks are. That helps motivate me to stay on track, helps me be accountable. So that would be my advice. By the way, I want to do a quick shout out to Richard in Michigan. He sent me an email, found out that I was interested in basketball. He says, hey, I'm 84 and I'm playing in the Senior Olympic Games every year. So can't wait till I'm 84 so I can play with the 80 to 84 age team. So something to look forward to, right, Pastor Jeff? another question had to do with thyroid. Here's an individual, Joan, watching us online. She says, our daughter was just diagnosed with low thyroid. Other than medications, what would be some things that we should consider? Now, the short answer here is that when we're dealing with low thyroid, especially if a test clearly shows that you have low thyroid, you don't want to be messing around playing the game of, nah, I don't want to be on medications. Because the thyroid medications are actually very close to bioidentical hormones. And they're very helpful in regulating thyroid activity. One of the fastest ways, one of the biggest shortcuts towards having a heart attack, a stroke, or even developing cancer is don't manage your thyroid well. Okay? So that's a fairly blunt way of saying, if you have a thyroid issue, be aggressive at managing it. Don't test it and then start some medicine and then, 6 months later, retest it. Be on top of it. Make sure that you are being optimally managed with thyroid, because thyroid is what turns on your metabolism and helps your body get rid of toxins. It helps, it does so many things. It lowers your risk of diabetes, heart disease, cancer, on and on and on and on. So be well managed with thyroid. Having said that, there are many things that we can do naturally. One of them is, well, it's just everything we've been talking about. Lower inflammation. The biggest cause of low thyroid is an autoimmune condition called hypothyroid or Hashimoto's thyroiditis, or autoimmune thyroiditis. It's just a fancy word, means that your body's making antibodies against the mechanisms of thyroid in your system. And that's the number one cause of low thyroid, which means we need to be aware of this inflammatory autoimmune condition. So everything we talked about today that hinges on controlling inflammation also is critical to addressing thyroid of any kind, because most of it is autoimmune. So treat the obvious. Treat vitamin D deficiency, real critical in optimizing thyroid. Make sure that you're digesting properly. A big cause of thyroid problems, you're just not digesting and therefore not absorbing the very nutrients that your body needs to support not only thyroid activity, but activity of any organ in your body. So optimize digestion. Indigestion or any bloating or gas is not just a social inconvenience. It's a sign your body's malnourished, even if you're eating a lot of food. So you got to fix that, and there's many natural strategies on how to fix that. Optimize your minerals. Many people with low thyroid, I run a comprehensive red blood cell mineral level, and they're low in almost every mineral. Okay, so which means that we need to optimize mineral status, first by fixing digestion and then optimizing any way we can. So that's the short list. There's many other things that can be done as well.
Alrighty, so we have a question from Sarah. We had to look this up, but Utkasuk, it's in Alaska, and she asked, when it comes to circulation and travel, how can I decrease my risk for travel-related circulation issues when traveling via flight for long distances?
All right, well, I mentioned in session two that when I did this Hunter Health profile, one of the tests was the factor V Leiden mutation. It's one of the things you learn in school, and you go like, that would never happen to me. Well, guess what? 35 years later, okay, I discover, I had it all along. So I'm the 10 to 15% of the population that have this mutation that makes me up to 800% more likely to have a clot while I'm flying long distance. So if you're on a plane where you're sitting more than 5 or 6 hours, serious risk of clotting and therefore having a pulmonary embolism. 70% of individuals who have a pulmonary embolism, a clot lodging in the lung, actually have this mutation that I have now. So the question is, do you want to know if you have it? I would hope so. Okay, because if you know you have that, that means you absolutely need to be on top of this issue of clotting risk, which further increases the motivation to stay focused on a comprehensive wellness program. Don't just exercise once a day, as valuable as that is. Stay active. Stay active on an hourly basis. I've just ordered a Jawbone Up, one of those bracelets, that it not only tells you how active you are during the day, how many calories you burn, etc., but it also reminds you after 60 minutes of inactivity. It'll buzz. And you go, oh, I need to get up. Okay? And so I sit and talk to people all day long. So don't be offended if I get up and walk around the office a little bit now that I'll be wearing that Jawbone Up. So those are actually, we laugh, but that's a critical part. Your inflammation can go up within an hour just because you're sitting too much. Okay, so in other words, we need to be more active than we are, okay? Not just daily, but hourly. Other things that can be done if you're at risk is there's a whole list of natural approaches that I'm following now that limit my risk of coming down with that problem. You can also talk to your physician about getting pre-medicated with believe it or not, like Coumadin, because that even though that can cause hardening of the arteries, I'd rather not have a clot while I'm flying. Yeah.
One more question here from Sylvia from North Dakota. How can I cure my severe colitis? And can colitis lead to colon cancer?
Okay. So colitis, any word that that ends with itis means it's inflammation. Okay, so everything that we've been talking about applies here as well. I've had many patients who have had ulcerative colitis, a very devastating autoimmune disease. We call it inflammatory bowel disease. It can devastate people's health. It can cause significant blood loss in the stool and weakness. People think they're just dying. But essentially, we need to reason from cause to effect. And we'll be looking more fully at strategies associated with more powerfully controlling inflammation. But it starts with the obvious things. You know, that list, those four most inflammatory foods. There's other inflammatory foods too, but the Harvard list, that's a good place to start. Avoid the very things that drive inflammation. That's first and foremost. Follow a broad plan, okay, and then get real specific about ways to improve colon health through optimizing digestion. And there's various, I use this product called Inflammacor, put out by Ortho Molecular Products, that is powerful for calming inflammation, especially in the digestive tract. And so there's many strategies that need to be fine-tuned for the individual. And this series is about looking at the big picture and establish a foundation for being successful.
I think those are all our questions from online viewers.
Okay, so we have more questions that we didn't get to tonight, but we will be addressing those again next week. So for now, go through those worksheets and look for some information this coming week on lab testing. Read the section in the website, dryoungberg.com, that looks at lab testing specifically. And then I'm going to be sending an email that gives you a little bit more information, and read chapter 10 in the book Goodbye Diabetes, which basically focuses on comprehensive lab testing. Good night.